Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
This is one of our first live shows, so you will note some audience participation throughout the podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Fourth Age. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this episode is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back, as always, and we also have with us this episode Spencer.
Hey everyone, it is great to be here. This episode is going to be really fun. We're discussing our first impressions of the Towers of Midnight, and even though we haven't all finished the book, apparently.
Yeah. I am sorry, but it's a couple of 6+ hour drives and various other things have conspired from getting all the way through the book so far. So,
well,
fair, I promise.
I guess we can forgive you because you got the book on Wednesday. So you didn't have as much time to read.
Yeah, I know. Everybody had to drive to get to the signings or something to get to the signings. It was such a shortened tour this time. There weren't a lot of options, so it was pretty brutal. I think, Andrew, you probably did the same thing I did. I drove all the way up. I left in the morning, spent, from 4 to 1 in the morning there. Went out to the parking lot, got in the car, and drove back for 9 hours, and then went to work.
Something close to that.
Yeah. I'm getting too old for this.
So we would definitely like to say that even though we will probably not be discussing the whole book, I am imagining it is a fairly safe bet that we will be discussing spoilers of things that happen in Towers of Midnight. So if you have not completely read the book, tune out now, come back to us later when she finished it, because the book is, wow, it is something else entirely.
And he hasn't even finished it yet.
Yeah.
Wait for the epilogue, man.
Oh my God.
All right, this is Brandon Sanderson giving you a warning that this podcast includes spoilers. Spoiler alert, don't listen unless you've read all the books. Otherwise, we will hunt you down and beat you up.
Thanks for that, Brandon. Anyway.
And as we've heard at the Provo signing, that might not be so idle a threat.
No. That wasn't Provo signing. That was San Diego Comic-Con.
I meant from the actual release that we had, or the recording that we did at the Provo signing. They actually, there was one gentleman that thankfully most of the listening audience who were listening via our live stream didn't catch, but apparently he dropped a huge spoiler right next to Brandon. And Brandon kind of openly chided him about, I'm pretty sure that everybody who's listening online and that really appreciates that spoiler. The guy was kind of like, I'm online. He's like, yeah, that's what the mic there's for.
Wow. How sad is it that I completely missed that?
Well, the thing is that almost everyone did. I kind of popped in at some point and said, just judging from the chat feed that we had going alongside the audio, I was like, it looked like everybody was kind of talking about something else and most everybody missed what he said. So, the light was just kind of with us all. So.
Oh, good. Good. What spoiler did he throw out there?
I don't know.
Do you even remember?
I didn't hear it either. I just remembered hearing Brandon speak up about it, and I was just like, okay, it's like, I know I missed it, and people are like, I missed it, what did he say?
I don't really care.
So if anybody did hear that particular spoiler, then they were very good about keeping it to themselves and not going off on a Watt rage.
What? That's one I haven't heard before.
Is that like a roid rage? What?
Well, I mean, it's similar. It's similar. It is a cousin to the geek or the nerd rage, which, is prevalent in online communities now. But this one is Wheel of Time centered, so it has to be something slightly different.
Oh, but darn it, now this is revealed toward the end of the book. Andrew, do you care radically if you find out who Masana was masquerading now?
No, I'm good with that. I don't remember where I was. I remember in my earlier scanning past that particular section.
Okay. What's the last scene that you've read? So we know where to... I mean, the last third of the book isn't very specific.
I know.
Grab that book.
Yeah.
Where did you leave off?
One thing I do have to say is, regardless of whether or not we say who Masato is actually masquerading as, well, okay.
Just since the beginning of 39. That was the end of the Threefold Land, is the title.
Oh, where she first takes off to the,
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're pretty far along then. You're pretty far along. I was only there yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
Late.
Yeah. Well, one thing I do want to say, regardless of whether or not we spoil who Masana was, I think the way that it was told to us is kind of like a throwaway line. It's like,
yeah.
Oh yeah, and they found Masana and she was masquerading as so-and-so and now we move on.
Yeah.
I mean, what?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh yeah, she was, well I'm going to say it, so you cover your ears if you want to. I was right. Da-da-da. I actually was right. It was Sinel, the brown, the dreamy brown, who had no friends, the solitary. Yeah, there were a lot of clues leading up to that. I'm not the only one who got that, believe me.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I was like, yep, people have been saying that for a while now.
I mean, that was kind of like the man and wife question. I mean, 90% of the people weren't told. It's completely obvious. We know exactly that.
Yeah, Berlaine and Galad. Mm-hmm.
Unlike
especially for the way her eyes lit up when he walked into the room.
Wait a minute, that's the Gaul.
Oh, yeah.
That's the Gaul, not the Forsaken.
Hey, now. We don't need to do crossovers.
I don't
too late.
Who was that undercook in Kyrian? Oh, you could tell them, Asherman. You could, their eyes glowed in the dark. You could tell them, they could freeze you with a look.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember her name, sorry.
Okay, hiding in the shadows.
Horrible, the last one was. I didn't even like talking
and,
about
and discussing other, you know, common fan theories. I think all three of us skipped to the glossary. Did you skip to the glossary, Andrew?
Yes,
no,
I did.
No, I haven't.
You haven't? Oh my gosh.
No.
All right, then you gotta duck out.
Yeah, you gotta duck out real quick because I'm gonna say
or
it.
Or read
out
the glossary
loud.
Right now.
Yeah. This seems more informative in the glossary than it did when it actually came out in the text that said, I mean, it came out in the text that said, all right, I'm gonna spoil it. Grendel killed Asmodian. There, I said it. But it didn't come out in the text to say it anywhere than that. In fact, it was, and I'm going to spoil another part of the story, too. You know, obviously, they found the sauna, the White Tower did, and part of that is because Grendel failed, is why they were able to capture her. And so Grendel is hurriedly packing up to leave, and there's Shadar Haran. And the line, and the line that's supposed to tell you that she killed Asmodian is, you're responsible for the death of three Forsaken.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's it? That I can come out and list them? I mean, really?
She knew who they were. He didn't need to name them.
But still, it's like, okay, that's all we get?
Yeah. I guess, well, Brandon said at the signing that they debated about that quite a bit. And he originally, I guess, if I'm remembering correctly, almost as a, not really, almost as an aside, stuck it in the glossary, and then Harriet loved it. She said, that's the perfect place for it. It has to stay there. And so he kept thinking, well, I should take it out of the glossary because it's a major spoiler. And she said, no, that's exactly the place for it. Leave it there.
Yeah,
that's
it
my
worked.
Recollection. That's
it
my
worked.
Recollection.
I like it there, actually. I like it in the glossary rather than in the actual text.
Yeah.
One, because it's easier to find when you want to reference to it. And two, because because it is kind of like you say, it's kind of like a throwaway. It's like, and Grendel killed Asmodian.
I was hoping for a little mental flashback from her point of view when she discovers him in the wine closet and Bale fires.
Yeah, I would love to have seen that scene just a little bit more.
This insect is toast.
You can come back now, Andrew. I think we're good.
I have a fairly good guess at what you were talking about, though. So. And I'm fairly certain that I, on the particular topic, that I was probably right.
Well, then voice your guess here. So, for the record.
I've said for quite a while that Grendel killed Asmodian. I mean, she seems to be the only logical one going through the list of the Forsaken, Slayer, the Golem, all various possibilities. I mean, the only other one would be Shadar Huron, and we really hadn't met him enough yet to know, you know, his ability. So it's just like all the evidence really kind of pointed towards her. So
I mean, I leaned between her and Alvienda. So I don't know. But anyway, move on before we say if he was right or wrong inadvertently.
Alvienda, really? I don't see why anyone ever considered her.
Because she was there, and we don't know what Moraine might or might not have taught her. I actually thought Moraine might have given her that task because
and
she was very concerned about.
And he walks into the wine room and he's surprised and says, "You," as in a form of surprise. If it had been Alvienda, he wouldn't have been surprised. He'd be like, "Oh, hi."
Well, particularly, yeah. He also kind of left her and Matt sitting by the fountain because they were all in like a little interior courtyard thing and he was playing music and Matt and Alvienda were there and then he left.
Yeah, right.
So I don't, but.
Yeah, I know it was a stretch, but I thought it was possible. It could have happened. Anyway, doesn't Moraine have a lot to catch up on? Whew.
Yeah, assuming that they get her out, I will say that the scene on the cover is pretty darn close to what actually happened, strangely enough. You know, it's actually a scene from the book. It's not just some random drawing.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that the tower is smooth metal.
The weird texture on the tower is not a smart idea, but
Tom's wearing a patched cloak instead of a large striped shawl.
Yeah. Color block shawl.
However, I was
surprised
to note that.
With no fluttering patches.
Yeah, I was surprised to note that Noel's staff that he has in the book is on the cover is actually, you know, spoken of in the book. So that was correct.
Oh, I missed that. What did it say? I thought he just got it from the same store at the mall that Maureen got hers a long time ago. You know, staffs are us.
Yeah, that would be. Well, it does have the same kind of headpiece on it.
Or Noel was actually a secret Wheel of Time fan and got it at the local replica vendor, an authorized replica of Moraine's staff from Eye of the World.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Speaking of interesting notes on replicas and vendoring, just an interesting point. I actually had the opportunity to ask Harriet, knowing Mr. Jordan liked to collect various things, including replicas of things that were in the series, like the Heron Mark sword and the Shatter Logoth dagger, Matt's Foxhead medallion. There is a Linearian.
I think I'm going to guess it's Ma-Alainir, because on a line is like that, pronounced like that. So I'm thinking it's Ma-Alainir, but the end is IR. But I could be wrong. It's going to be a Mafo, Maria, and find out.
But yes, they apparently have already talked to museum replicas about possibly creating a replica. So Woot, another Wheel of Time object, is possibly going to be into production for us to purchase.
Another Wheel of Time object I can't afford. I have a chance of acquiring as I do the real thing.
The Dragon Mount Forum moderators, they now have a new term for their banhammer.
For their what hammer?
The banhammer.
I am not getting that.
Banned from the forum.
B-A-N. Ban.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Okay, I can laugh now. Sorry. I hate it when I have to have stuff explained to me, but I just didn't hear you.
Okay, well, let's see what
we
got.
Well, we're really jumping all over the place here.
Yeah, there were several, like Brandon told us there were several plot threads that were going through this book. It was not at all as focused as the Gathering Storm. And I liked it as much, I think. I enjoyed it very much, even though it's in all over the place. And there were some times when it's like, okay, now we need to go back to this character, and we didn't for a few chapters yet. And that was, there were a few points when I would have liked that to have maybe been arranged differently, but it was still really good. I think it's that, and you guys can tell me what you think, but I think it would be pertinent. I think it would be good to maybe go through the plot line, go by plot line and discuss them that way. It's the easiest way to, you know, actually discuss what's happening in the book. What do you think?
That's probably true.
Yeah.
I mean, the only other option I could think of that would make sense is to first say what your favorite scene is so far and then go by plot line, whatever you think.
Mm.
I don't know. There were so many. I don't know if I could even pick one, really.
My favorite scene so far, ooh. Well, the one that immediately into my head, simply because I've read it the most recently, is the one in the epilogue with Ulver. But,
yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Because
we can't tell Andrew about that one yet.
Well, just not the part at the end where Talmanis has to go running off, but before that, when we're getting a peek into this little kid's head, it's like,
yeah.
That,
well, you know, he doesn't seem like a little kid anymore. He seems like a young man.
Oh,
though.
No. Yeah, he's
really grown.
Acting, although, and I'm going to have to find it so I can quote it again. I did like the little bit where he says something along the lines of, Talmanis mumbled something, reaching over and tossing a handful of dice without losing his place in the book. He was an all right fellow, though a little stiff. Ulver would not choose to have a man like him on a good night of drinking and hunting serving girls. As soon as Ulver was old enough to go drinking and hunting serving girls, he figured he would be ready in another year or so. I like that line. But yeah, that's my favorite scene so far, I think. Even though there are a lot of others that if I reread it, I'd be like, oh no, that's my favorite. Wait, no. Right now, that's my favorite scene. What about from what you've read, Andrew?
Actually, I really kind of like Rand's return to Banderabon and just the buddy Jesus Buddha effect. You know, he comes into the city and just talks to and apologizes to people, and suddenly they just kind of like click into their proper place, and suddenly there's an army of around 500 people, and you know they head out to the ships, and you know, oh, you opened all the wrong sacks, and the weirdness of, you know, Rand, you know, explaining it that way, and he's like, you mean to say that we opened exactly the number of sacks with boiled grain and food in them when we first tried to open them, and that the rest of them are all fine? And Rand's like, yep, that's exactly what I'm saying. And, you know,
yep.
there's no given explanation, you know, it's not, you know, the creator is smiling on us or, you know, anything like that. It's just, you opened the wrong sacks, and the city organizing and beginning to write itself, you know, just coupled in with, you know, Rand's new Zen attitude. That was also kind of partial to Nynaeve's first big discovery in the book, the one concerning the Ashaman's madness in the tank. And I had a weird flash when I first heard about it, even though it's nowhere near similar to the shadows from Babylon 5, like the shadow vessels and all kind of looking like wicked flying space fighters and stuff. And it's kind of, you know, Nynaeve figuring out new things about her delving and whatnot. And so she could see into the brain, and that was like latched in and everything. And then that combined with Rand's weird, like Oreo cookie madness, which I assume is, you know, I assume that the glowing white layer is a direct sign of interaction from the creator. I can't see what else explains that.
I don't know. I told you that I remembered other scenes. They would become my favorite, but another one that's a big one for me was when Perrin was at the top of Dragon Mountain, the wolf dream.
Oh, no.
It was all the wolves?
Yeah.
No, before that.
Oh. No, he dragged himself up there. Yeah, he drags himself up there and he's watching this whole epiphany of Rand's, not knowing what's coming from that.
Perrin is actually present during Rand's epiphany.
That's awesome.
It is. And it's just, the visualization is different because he's in the wolf dream at the time, which someday we need to discuss how Perrin can be seeing Rand how Rand is in the wolf dream at the same time he's in the real world, but that's another, but the visualization is so different, but that really cool.
Well. Yeah, it really was. And I brought this up. I'm not even sure what my favorite scene is. There were so many that I really like. I do have to say, and I never thought I would say this, but one of my favorite ones is probably Perrin making Ma aligner. That was just like, oh my goodness. And I actually have to say that, thank you, Brandon, I actually like Perrin again. He stopped being emo Perrin and become a real man. You know, he's become a real man, a hero, a legend. You know, the man, the myth, the legend.
You said that was before all the wolves were on Dragon Mount?
Hmm?
I was going back to what Spencer was saying. Because for some reason, I don't remember reading that, but I remember there being a bunch of wolves on Dragon Mount. So I'm trying to figure out.
Well, they were clustering around Dragon Mount at several points.
Yeah.
During the, it was mentioned that they were gathering there.
Okay. I might not have actually.
And at the end of it, they're all jumping around and yipping and doing little wolf dances and everything because the last hunt is coming. And that's actually, it's actually a really strong philosophical key there, because hanging upon Rand's epiphany was basically the victory of the Dark One when all would have become nothing, no hunt, no wolves, no anything, or the last hunt comes. So, I mean, because Rand's recovered the goodness in him, now we actually get to go to the last battle and have a resolution. Had he not, the Dark One would have just won right there. Apparently, that's what I get from that.
Yeah, that's exactly what it says. Is the choice has not yet been made. The choice of whether we go to the last hunt or whether we die, we succumb to nothingness, and it's not our choice to make, but it still needs to be made.
Yeah.
It's really kind of interesting, too, that Rand's epiphany leads to such drastic changes. I mean, we've kind of already mentioned that, you know, things in the world start going right around Rand as opposed to, you know, catastrophically wrong. But, you know, I also remember him coming into the Stone of Tyr for the first time afterwards, and he's looking along the lines of stuff, and he walks up to Wirimon and his associates and is like, go back and tell your masters the time when you can hide from me is over.
Mm.
And, you know, and just the entire, you know, I can see Dark Friends.
Yeah. Well, and then in Malden, I don't know, have you gotten that far yet? To, Rand comes to Malden, and it's, wow.
Don't remember now. Again.
I must have been asleep when I read that one.
Much is fuzzy in my brain.
I think it's Malden. Yes, it's Malden. That's where Isserald is,
Andrew.
Right? Isserald is in Malden. Am I missing something?
I don't remember.
Malden's where Fael was kept captive.
Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, not Malden then. Then I'm completely off. Okay.
Oh, Meridon?
Meridon, there you go.
Meridon?
Yeah.
Remember what chapter that is?
No.
When he rescues Isserald and...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's Meridon, yeah.
Yeah, and it is, oh my gosh, what? And then it's like, oh, yes, that's amazing. And then you turn to the side and there's Dark Friends who have killed themselves. Okay.
I guess I was asleep for that, too. Oh, my goodness. I really have to read this again.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of pointed out when you first meet them by Isseralda, but the Dark Friend, Lord and Lady, who are supposed to be ruling
Meridon.
Right.
Right.
the lady,
right.
She jumped
out the window.
Yeah. They can't even see the battlefield that Rand's on where he's blasting the Trolloc, and yet they still see his light so much that she jumps out the window and he pokes at his eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is not the only eye poking going on in the book. I mean,
Well, everybody knew that. That's not a spoiler anymore. That's been so foreshadowed, you know.
Yeah.
So have
that's one we can't even say, oh, yeah, we were right, because it was so foreshadowed. It was like...
Yeah, we knew it was happening.
That was another good scene. The chapter is The End of a Legend, I think, or something like that. It's basically Trigitha and Matt going out for a drink, quote unquote, and you know, Brigida's drinking milk. and she talks about having gone into the tower before.
Oh yeah, that was great.
You know, are you sure you haven't heard this story before? It was like, you know, kind of upset because, you know, it was a good story and, you know, no.
It was a nice reversal.
But her, and I love her going in and like explaining, it's like, you know, well, if you go in through one of the terrain grills, the rules apply, and you know, there are less rules if you enter through the tower, but at the same time, you know, there's
less protection
less protection. How did you get hung anyway?
But that was a nice reversal with Brigida, because she spent the last however many books, and she was ripped out of Teleron Riad whining and complaining because she had to live up to all these legends that everybody remembered, and then somebody doesn't remember one, and she's all like, what? Missed?
Yeah.
Well, and on top of that,
and then the, oh, no, go ahead, Andrew.
You know, on top of that, too, you also get the, it's like, well, you know, how did you get back out? And we didn't. We died. And Matt kind of brings to the point, like, well, wait a minute. If you died, how does anybody ever hear the story?
Yeah. Well, and the thing is that Matt does come back later. I mean, it's not that much of a spoiler. It's on the cover. We know that Matt and Tom and Noel go into the Tower of Genji. And the story does come back up. And Tom remembers one that's similar, but just enough different that it's not, that you know it's based on the same thing.
Yeah.
The story is that, I can't remember the lady's name now, wandered an endless corridor of mazes looking for the fountain of healing to save her one true love. Well, yeah, duh, that's it. But she wanted for 100 days rather than, I think it's the 60 that make up a month, that make up 2 months. But
well, she said she didn't remember how long they lasted after their food and water ran out.
That's true.
But it's beyond belief that it could have been 40 days with no food and water.
Yeah.
I mean, not even a hero, especially a wounded one, can last that long. But legends, you know, legends get exaggerated as time goes on. And 100 days is a nice round figure, you know.
Well, and then there's two things about the story that Tom knows. One, the end of the story is that she dies on the other side of the wall and can hear the bubbling fountain.
Oh.
So she died. When Brigitte fell, she was pretty darn close to where she needed to be to make the pact with the Eelfin. But the only people that would know that would be the Eelfin. So we know that they are responsible for the spreading of the story. Whether it was told, given an answer or boon to someone who had come through asking to hear the story, or just what, how the story got out, we know that they're responsible for it.
Yeah. There was,
posted it on their blog and, you know.
they just did a podcast and sent it out.
Yeah.
As since we're talking about legends and stories and that, I was thoroughly amused through the entire thing, and every time Matt encountered a variation of one of his own stories.
Yes.
Particularly the number of times that Matt apparently faces down and, you know, either dices with or bargains his way out of death itself's hands.
That's pretty darn close.
I love being in the inn where Tom basically twits Matt about that. Oh, he's in character as a Mirandian who's been sent out to spy at this lonely tavern. Oh, my talents are so wasted here. If I had only been sent to the camp of the indestructible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, the famous from Coffin.
Well, then, like, the guardsman is like, Matt Coffin, the Raven Prince?
his fame deceived him.
Yeah. Well, and then still on that, you know, I like how he finally took care of his pest problem.
Okay, now I don't know what way to put it.
Well, he used your favorite method of body disposal, Virginia.
Oh, I know, I love it. Finally, somebody gets it. Kick him off into the void, dude. It's a really great disposal system. I wonder if centuries down the road, you know, there's going to be an interdimensional waste disposal crisis. How long does it take to fill up infinity with your trash that you got to get rid of in your dead bodies?
Well, yeah, and he's like, I hope you live. I hope you can't die, because I want you to just fall forever.
Yeah, that was great. Pest disposal, that was really awesome. If only Karen could have done something like that, you know, with his pest. Now you haven't got to that scene yet, have you, Andrew?
Probably not.
Okay, you want to probably cover your ears, or you're probably going to be spoiled.
You will probably be spoiled if you want to.
If you
want to.
All right, well, and the scene with Perrin and Slayer, un-freaking-believable. Unbelievable. That whole section of the book is just unbelievable, you know, where he's doing. I mean, he does spend all this time practicing in Gulfstream and everything, but boy, did he get good quick. You know, and then I love the scene where he basically throws it in Egwene's face. Oh, yeah. You know, like, he's acting like, she's such a noob there, because he can do all this stuff she can't. He's, like, stopping Balefire with his hand. Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can't do that? Wow.
Yeah. It's Teller Onryad. The weaves don't exist if I don't want them to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Egwene's eyes are popping out and her mouth is dropping over. It's like, I was supposed to be like the great dreamer, mistress of Teller Onryad. Everybody looks up to my abilities. You can do this. You know, she was like totally losing it.
Yeah, yeah.
In an Ammerlin sort of way.
Yeah, well,
losing it.
Yeah, but I like what he said. He's like, I'm a wolf. This is my place. You can't beat me here.
That was so awesome. I mean, it's just like Egwene was so completely made of awesome during the last book, and such the, you know, the queen of battles, you know, the total, you know, green eye for the eye, capable, commanding, you know, heroic, unfreaking believable. And so it's like Granny just, RJ just felt like they had to take her down a little bit in this book, you know, and she was. I mean, she got taken down in her personal life a little bit, and she got taken down on a Teller Onryad skills in a big way. Don't you think at some point in time she's going to be grabbing Perrin by the ear, saying, listen, tell me more about this.
Only if they survive the coming month. I mean, you know the state of the world at the end of the epilogue.
Yeah. I have to say that this is based on nothing, but after a couple of the scenes with Perrin where he just got so good, I just had the strongest feeling in my mind that Perrin is not going to survive the last battle. Maybe Fael either. And then there were certain indications later on in the book that actually might also be the case, but they were way late in the book, so I'm sure you haven't got there yet.
I had some concern over Perrin because it occurred to me as I was reading the early chapters in the book, we've got from prophecy that Rand will die and live again.
Yeah.
We have from the pseudo spoiler that Robert Jordan himself gave us that he was planning an Outrigger sequel to the series in which revolved around Matt and Swan, implying that Matt lives. And if the entire Wheel of Time series is about balance, having one person who lives of the three and one person who lives and dies, or rather dies and lives again, that means there has to be a person who just dies. And it kind of only leaves Perrin. And I'm like, oh, okay. And, you know, I could very well see that happening. So, I mean, there's a legitimate concern, and I probably haven't read all of the nods that it could happen. I mean, obviously, there's one really early in the books in a conversation between Moradin and Grendel, and the weird Necronomicon Ex Mortis-like flesh-covered book thing.
Yeah, and the prophecy in it, which is actually put in at the very end of the book, they have the prophecies of the shadow. And it says, yea, and the broken wolf, the one whom death has known, shall fall and be consumed by the midnight towers. And his destruction shall bring fear and sorrow to the hearts of men, and shall shake their very will itself. Which, it does kind of point to Perrin dying. I mean, but the broken wolf, unless for some reason, I don't think that the broken wolf refers to Perrin as we know him now. I think it might. Because, unless I'm mistaken, isn't the crown of Saldia called the Broken Crown?
Yeah.
So, that there is that connection there, but that is not something that's going to happen for a while yet. If Perrin somehow gets made king, it's going to have to be after the last battle, because there's not time for it to happen beforehand.
Yeah,
I mean, major spoiler, but at the end of this book, the last battle is here. It's not knocking at the gate, it's in the freaking door.
Yeah. The opening scenes have actually, you know, begun, really.
Yeah, one of our, the first among equals for our tower guard had already actually read through the book. And, when Brandon was doing our personalizations at the end of the night, the personalization he had put in this book was Cry Havoc. And then he said that when he comes for the signing for Towers of Midnight, the personalization will be in Lift the Dogs of War.
Mm.
So,
I'm not that clever to get
proper things like that side. I mean, what I asked him for my book was how much it would cost to get a Towers of, or a Memory of Light spoiler, and he put more money than you have. So that's in my book now, forever and permanent marker.
That's good. That's really good. That's really good.
I kind of had to spell out mine, obviously. I decided to have Zerovian and Tumanshima Taishite put in the book.
Yeah. Awesome. So that had to be, yeah. I was telling Steve earlier that I had major technological problems the whole evening that I was trying to record, and then when I got back, I found that my compact flash card had evidently decided to fail for my digital recorder, so nothing I recorded that would have been any good to use exists. I'm just devastated. But one of the questions that I asked Brandon was one that was on our list and that we had discussed, and is one of my sort of crazy theories was that part of the last battle. Well, first I asked him what happens if you are Balefired in Telemundia, which we discussed when we had Matt Hatch on about the World of Dreams. And there was some batting around between him and Harriet, which, like I say, I thought I was recording, so I was kind of just caught up in the conversation and didn't memorize what they said, so I can't quote you verbatim. But they said it's actually, they're not sure. It happened with Robin and Rand. They were all thinking that he was in Telemundia, but then he was there in the flesh, so that might be different. And they're not really sure. They have to think about if there are any of the weird sort of time reversal effects that go on by being Balefire in Telemundia, and what happens if massive amounts of Balefire are used in Telemundia. Does that destroy not only the pattern, but the, you know, the world between the worlds and everything else? And I got a big raffle card for that one. Also for the second part of it, which was my crazy theory that I think a lot of the last battle is going to be taken by Rand into Telemundia and possibly by Perrin as well. You know, and Rand, I think Rand will decide to do this in order to spare the world from the ramifications of a huge battle with the One Power. And I don't know if, you know, if he himself has the power to take large sections of people with him, you know, as though it were a portal stone, or if he'll be able to arrange it in some fashion. But, you know, I got a raffle on that one too. But I thought, I knew I would. I had to ask.
Yeah. Well, your mention of Balefire and Telemundia makes me think of Nynaeve, Aes Sedai, the test for the shawl that she did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I loved when she came out. They were like, "You failed." Excuse me? You not only pushed me harder than any other initiate that has ever gone through those rings, but I behaved admirably.
Right.
There's absolutely no use for Aes Sedai calm and demeanor when people are dying.
Yeah. Well, it's actually Egwene who said that she was pushed harder than anybody else because Nynaeve wouldn't have any way to know. But still, you know, she said, "I did what I needed to do. If I needed to run to get there, it was because people were in peril. If I, you know, wasn't calm and I used weaves I shouldn't have used, I was protecting other people and keeping them from being killed. I was sick and tired of seeing more children." Well, she didn't say it that way, but she said, "I couldn't see any more children and men and women, you know, being tortured and killed. I did what I needed to do. And if that's wrong, then I'd do it again."
And I especially love when they're like, "We will discuss the forbidden weave." And she's like, "No, we won't. Go away."
I know. Sorry.
Well, I mean, it was. It was just that, you know, I'm sorry, but it's like, if you can't trust my judgment, then I'd rather not have the shawl. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
She was awesome.
Like, I'm not going to go around willy-nilly balefiring everything inside. You know, I understand that it's dangerous and that, but there are, you know, in the particular situation, it's the only way I know to actually kill Darkhound. So, you know, sue me.
Yeah, and you know, she's the only one there who had actual worldly experience with any form of Shadow Spawn and, you know, actually, you know, being out there fighting the things. And, you know, she showed that in the way she responded to them is, "I'm sorry, but I'm a little bit more knowledgeable than you when it comes to, you know, the actual world outside of Tarvalon."
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But then they pass her, you know, after all that, they do a vote. I didn't realize it was a vote. I kind of assumed it would be a one black ball and too bad sort of a situation. But I really do wonder, maybe she wouldn't have because Nynaeve was her friend, but I almost wonder if the Amyrlin wouldn't have tried to overrule that if they'd have seriously insisted on failing her, because they really did push the bounds on that test. It was ridiculous, you know. I mean, they almost killed her. She was in such bad shape when she got out. They had to heal her instantly or she probably would have died.
Oh, yeah, but even if they hadn't have raised her to Aes Sedai, she would have been like, screw you, I'm going to keep channeling anyway. The last battle's coming, get over it.
Yeah, you can't stop me. I'm going to be at the last battle. Randall Thor has asked for me specifically. I would have been there anyway, but he's requested it, so there I am. So, yeah, go about yourself.
Just try and stop me.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, too. She's one of the strongest Aes Sedai living. Could they stop her?
So yes, have to with get a full circle of 13, they could stop her easily. Yeah. With a full circle of 13, they could stop her easily.
But that would be against Tower law. She would have to be tried, judged, and then I think that the Amyrlin might have a little bit of say so in that too. You know.
Well, no, they wouldn't steal her. They would just hold her. This initiate of the Tower is trying to run away, and we have to use our forces to keep her from doing so. And Egwene would be like, no, you don't, shut up. And so the problem would be...
Not only that, but I'm sure there was the big image of if they, if she says that basically Randus requested her to fight at his side at the last battle, and she intends to be there, so if they hold her, wouldn't they just expect Randall Thor to come charging in there and say, excuse me?
Yeah.
I believe I'll have her back now, thank you. They could not have won that fight. There's no way. They were smart to back off.
Yeah. Well, and then they go head first into another fight against the Dragon Reborn, who is having people study this and has the memories of a former age and says, I'm going to do this to defeat the Dark One. And you're like, no, you're not. That's stupid. Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There was some discussion. I want to say if it was... yes, it was definitely among Power Guard before the Cincinnati signing, as to whether people's understanding of the cycles of time are correct, if they are actually what they think they are. Because at least one person, and I'm not remembering the names at the moment, had basically conjecturized that maybe the Third Age is not the Third Age at all, and that we're actually coming back toward the close of the circle as opposed to the opening of another length of the turn. And there was some nature over whether the cycle is much shorter than we figure it is. Now, of course, I kind of interposed that, you know, Robert Jordan had said that there were seven ages to the wheel and that, you know, we had to go through that, which is not something apparently that had been previously known in this particular conversation. So, but yeah, there was some interesting debate over, you know, whether our perception of the ages and time is correct as well.
Yeah, we had some discussion about that too. It's almost too philosophical to even make a difference at this point.
Oh, there was another thing. And, I won't necessarily say it was one of my favorite scenes, but it was certainly one of those ones where you're starting the book, I'm like, you know, we haven't seen Padme Thane in quite a while. I wonder where he is. And then we got a scene with Padme Thane, and I'm like, I don't wonder where he is anymore. I really, really don't. As a matter of fact, I kind of want to run screaming from any place Padme Thane is now.
Yeah.
He's like become, you know, it wasn't bad enough that he was like Mordoth and Padme Thane dark friend. Now he's like got this serious Gollum overtone and who knows what else. I mean, beyond creepy in the prologue.
I tell you what, though, if they ever make this into... Well, they are. If they ever make the later books into a movie, Padme Thane will be one of the characters that would be fun to play. But I think it would be something similar to the stories that we hear of Heath Ledger as the Joker in Dark Knight.
Yeah.
You know, just to be in character, you would have to be just kind of out there. And, you know, people wouldn't want to spend time with you in that way because you're just creepy. I mean, even off screen, you would have to retain a little bit of that creepy.
Yeah. But, you know, I actually think that it would be more like Gollum in Lord of the Rings movies. I think it'd be 90% CGI so I don't even know if you'd really need anybody playing them particularly. And whoever it would be would probably be in a suit, you know, they'd be in a CGI suit or something, you know.
Yeah.
I don't think he would, because you think of Gollum, and Gollum's been alive for a couple for several millennia. That is not true of Patton Fane. Patton Fane is just a twisted, sick, disgusting man, but he's still a man. The body he wears is still that of a man, even though he's filed his teeth, I think.
Yeah, what's that all about? Why did he need to do that?
To remain creepy, obviously. I'll tell you what,
holding a dagger so that it cuts your hand is not creepy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, Andrew, you might want to step away, because I'm going to quickly discuss the epilogue a little bit here. That shot that we have of the Aiel with the red veil.
Yeah, I was just looking at that.
Just taking it off, and I could just envision the crazy eyes and the pointed teeth. If this book ever gets made into a movie, I will not let my children see it, because that will induce nightmares.
Yeah, what is that all about? What is with the dark Aiel? I didn't get that.
I have to assume, my assumption is that it's the same as similar to what Patton Fane did to the Trollocs in the prologue, is he just said corrupted some Aiel. I could be wrong. Andrew, it's safe to come back now.
You know, I'm trying to remember too, there was another scene where I went, aha, I was right, and I can't even remember what it is now. Well, there was one big one that I think everybody got right. You know, Barrow Lane and the Man in White. Everybody had that. I mean, there were a few Guy Shine votes, but yeah, pretty much everybody had that. And there's something else. I got it. No, I'm saying to myself, yes, I got it. And I cannot remember at this moment in time what that even was.
Well, I must say that I did like the scene. I did like the Shanahar between Fael and Perrin, where they finally just sit down and talk about everything. It's like, yes, this is good. This is very good. and then later in the book, you know, they finally come out with what marrying Fael means to Perrin, you know, the broken crown and all that. She's second in line for succession. And Perrin knows this? Since when did Perrin know this? What?
That's
only a couple chapters yet. Well, no, she, I assume she told him just on, by the way that she said it. Perrin was still uncomfortable with this, but he knew it. It's like, wait, how come we didn't? What?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know there had been a little bit of talk about Dovrum taking over should Zenobia die, but yeah, no, I mean, my assumption on it was that there was a particular way the crown was passed, indicating that, you know, if Fael did inherit, then technically parents sort of inherited out of some sort of weird marriage birthright type thing. But, I don't know. It doesn't seem to really apply now, but yeah, no, I had always kind of assumed that Dovrum was somewhere in the middle. And
yeah.
I thought I was wrong about that, apparently. Maybe
he's
him removes him from contention.
Yes, but I don't think Fael would factor that into her equation. She says she's second, and to me that means that her father is next in line. She's just second after him.
But if
the exile removes him out of the line, then she's next in line for the throne when Zenobia dies. Which is a creepy thought.
So we don't really know that if Dovrum has been officially exiled, because he kind of assumes that Zenobia would do it because he's been following Rand. But we never actually, I think, got confirmation that Zenobia gave the order, so.
Yeah, and she doesn't even really say in this book. She says something about, we'll have to discuss that later. Oh, my uncle, yeah, that's right.
Oh,
we have to mention that later.
The Borderlanders, oh my gosh. Finally, we have some sense to their madness.
Yeah.
And it's not the Mondred, which is a plus.
Yeah, that was pretty odd. I didn't like that. I didn't love that. I thought that was kind of...
I did not like it at all. It was like, really? Really? You guys are that stupid?
Yeah, really? Seriously, dude? Really?
You're just going to randomly take all of your armies out of your lands, your fortifications, where you're supposed to stand to defend against the Blight.
Yeah.
Just so that you can go slap some guy and ask him a question. Really?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, that's good stewardship. Yeah. risk of getting bail fired, you know?
Yeah, and he's like, if I had met with you 1 month earlier, I would have killed you, first off, and secondly, I wouldn't be able to answer your question. You have no idea how stupid you were behaving.
Yeah, it's pretty strange. That just seemed like a really thin reed, you know, to, like you say, pack up your entire army, leave your country, you know, half protected with the last battle imminent just because of some stupid prophecy that we don't even know is real. I don't know. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me, but then I'm not a king or a queen. Would not have done that myself, personally. And, you know, couldn't they have sent, like, minions?
Yeah.
Personally, if I was going to go up and smack the Dragon Reborn, I believe I'd send a minion.
Well, okay, I can understand them leaving to go find the Dragon Reborn to ask him the question that's this time what important to them. I can understand that. But they took every single bit of their armies out of the borderlands.
No, they left enough for defense. They said that several times. I'm sure you left enough to defend the Blight. You know, didn't take everyone. But they took a substantial portion of their strength, which I thought was really not smart.
No, a token guard. A token guard. 100 people per person. That's about all you need. That's all you need.
Enough.
And if you can't followers, and you're good. You don't need to enter the borderlands of their armies right when Tarmon got on good. Anyway.
But what is this, you know, with walking up and slapping the Dragon Reborn? Kat Swain did that, too, and I thought, you know, even though she was an Aes Sedai and a really strong one, you know, that takes a real pair of, pardon the expression, brass ones, you know, to just haul off and smack the Dragon Reborn. I mean, this is like the most powerful channeler to come along the pike in eons, and let's
this is why they're in Tarmodding.
He hadn't been any too stable most of that time. I don't believe that's something that I would recommend as an introduction.
No.
They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't do that to another ruler. You know what I'm saying? They wouldn't walk up to, say, the Queen of Andor, and the first thing they do is haul off and, you know, whack her one with their fist, you know, or open hand or whatever. I mean, you just don't do that. That's not done in any circles. I just, I don't know.
I would have loved to have seen the maidens just remove one of their hands, just one, and it would have been good. Just right after she slaps them, her hand gets cut off. Everyone's
sorry,
Karakarn,
it was instinct, you know?
Yeah, everyone's stunned. They're like, shoot.
Oh, let's see, would the next three like to step up and have a go? Everybody loses something, as Perrin says.
But speaking of crazy people and not understanding them fully, what is with Child BR?
Oh, he's always been. He's been always over the edge.
Like,
that guy's never
more crazy than originally.
Yeah, at least Bornhold is slightly sane, and he gets it a little bit. He's like, oh, yeah, the Shanchen, yeah, they were in Falme, and he would have fought against them. That might be true. But BR's just like, no, crazy, killy, stabby person.
Red, evil, the Matt, evil, Perrin, evil, all, Shadowspawn, you know, come on, guys.
Evil.
They're all bad. I will not change my mind. What a loser.
Loser. I don't know. It is.
I mean, like, all the children are a little bit nice. Yeah.
Well, but this, like, when we first met him, he was just outright convinced that, you know, Perrin was Shadow Spawn. I mean, you know, his eyes say it, and he killed two children of the light, therefore he has to be Shadow Spawn. And then, like, after that, it's just every little thing, even seeing Perrin, like, is just an indication that You see her and something goes wrong, ergo reinforces Shadow Spawn. And you're just like, okay, but, you know, dude, kind of going the way of the prophet here.
Oh, yeah. Perrin said several times that he can smell on them, not Galad, because Galad's a little bit more sane, but on the rest of the children, he smells the zealotism.
Yeah.
Is that even a word? It is now. He smells their kind of weird
fanaticism.
Yeah, the fanaticism. Well, I don't want to say fanaticism because we're fanatics. But
they're just fanatics in a bad way. We're fanatics in a good way.
Well, they're zealots is the thing.
Well, that's true too. Both are applicable. Zealot implies a religious fervor, which they really aren't religious, but
yes, they are. That the entire foundation of the Children of the Light is a religious fervor.
Well, I suppose as religious as anything gets in the Wheel of Time world. There really isn't a formal religion. It's just the light and the dark. I mean,
the light
like,
will protect us from the shadow as long as we are stallion
like,
is true.
Well,
that
it's like
religion.
Anything, it's like maybe Zoroastrianism or something, you know, worshipping the light. It's a very informal, I don't want to say primitive, but kind of. It's a very basic and almost primitive religion, if you want to call it that, yeah.
But religious Zoroastrianism nonetheless.
Yeah, so fanatics. But yeah, he thinks they smell wrong. And he felt the same way about the prophet and the prophet's men. They had the same stink of wrongness to them. Which I don't know how a misbegotten belief like that can create a scent in a person, but okay.
Well, it's not the belief, it's the action, the way they behave.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
wouldn't be surprised. Well, and you know that the wolf and dog instincts in general are tuned to more than just what that person's emotions are right now. That they can somehow sense something even deeper.
My dog doesn't like you. There's something wrong with you. My dogs don't like bad people. So what other massively incredible scenes?
I can't even remember where this one is, but I think it's probably after where you are, Andrew. But when Lon finally gives in, I like that scene.
That's at the very end, yeah.
No, not at the very end when they're not in the epilogue, but because there's really four scenes that we get from Lon. There's the one in the prologue, there's there's five scenes, excuse me. The one in the prologue, there's the other one where he gets the other three that kind of start following him from the inn, another one where he gets a caravan, and then the one that I'm talking about, and then the one in the epilogue.
Yeah.
And the one that I'm talking about, which I think was on the border of Arafel. Yeah, I think it was on the border between Kandor and Arafel. Still, it's like, yes! Yes! Ooh, I like.
And as an aside to that, don't you love the scene where Nynaeve goes to visit Morel?
Yes. You have something that belongs to me. That's a matter
okay,
of opinion. No. I've just been raised. Give me the ball. Fine. Here.
Hand him over.
That's so interesting, the number of people that at the end of this book end up either bonded or married.
Well, it's a time of resolution, one way or the other.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah.
And, of course, we still have the... this is going to be probably past where you are, too, Andrew. Are you back or are you still gone?
I can still be gone.
Sorry.
Sorry. What was with the final trip through the glass columns with Avienda seeing the future?
I enjoyed that, actually.
Oh,
I really
that creeped
did enjoy
me
that.
Out. That
it
creeped
was
me
creepy.
Out. I hope,
it was so
I hope that's
creepy.
Not set in, I hope that's not set in stone and she can change that.
Me too,
holy
me too. Although I did like that we saw that Avienda is going to have quadruplets. She's not going to inherit Elaine's two and have two of her own. No, she's going to have quadruplets. I did like that we saw that. But still, it's like, wow. Oh, wow. Okay, now
I know. And we know the strange thing about the quadruplets, too, which actually, I was right. I think I mentioned this on a podcast a long, long time ago that I thought they'd probably be born channeling, born able to channel, but they went beyond that even. They hold the power all the time. They are never without the power. Woo.
Yeah, well, I don't think that's the weird thing that Min saw. That is extraordinary. I'm going to have to disagree. I don't think that's the weird thing that Min saw. Because, you know, the last battle is on the doors, and Avienda is not pregnant yet. So something has to change.
What about the quadruplets? Something odd about them. I thought that was what's going to change about them.
In my mind, the something odd, as to me, has always referred to the way they're conceived. Well, and
maybe.
And then she thinks of a couple of his brothers as, you know, they took more towards the Wetlander side. Well, there's not, okay, they have a quarter Wetlander in their blood, but really? There's Wetlander side they can take too?
It was only one.
I mean, Avienda's full Aiel. Rand is half Aiel.
Right.
Okay.
Well, there was only one of them that had the dark hair and the look of a Wetlander, I think.
Of
the boys.
I guess one in four out of is likely to get the quarter of the blood that is Wetlander, isn't he?
Yeah, I suppose and that's probably true. I think the dark hair, of course, you know, there wasn't a lot of dark hair behind the royal line of Andor either, which is what Rand's Wetlander blood comes from. I think, Dylan was light-haired too. Most of them were pretty fair. I suppose he could have, well, he didn't have Tarangale, so I don't know where he would have got that. I guess it was behind him somewhere. If you consider that was dominant genetically, but still, if it's dominant, one of the parents has to display that. So we'd have to assume that there was something, you know, dark-haired behind Avienda too, but I don't know. Maybe genetics aren't the same in Manly. Could happen. I mean, if you've got two light-haired, blue-eyed people and they have children, they can't have dark-haired, brown-eyed kids. They can't. They only have the light-haired, blue-eyed genes to pass on, especially the blue eyes. That's really locked in stone. But as I said, two dark-haired people can both be carrying the recessive gene for light eyes and have light-eyed kids. But maybe, like I say, maybe it's not the same.
Hence my idea that the something odd has to be something in their conception.
Well, maybe it's
anyway.
Like in dogs. Maybe it's, oh, I wouldn't want to see this, but maybe it's like in dogs who can have a multiple sire litter.
Creepy.
But I think that would kind of annoy Rand and maybe upset Avienda.
Yeah. Hmm. Anyway.
You can come back now, Andrew.
Yeah, we're good, Andrew. Come back.
How can you tell when we say to come back?
I am focusing on something else, and so I can still hear you talking, but I'm not attending to the words that you are.
Oh, wow.
And usually,
tricky.
Usually when you say come back, Andrew, and that is it just distinct enough that I can actually pick it out as opposed to anything else you might be saying.
Yeah, when we say Andrew, we actually get his attention.
Yeah, and we yell, like, okay, Andrew. Wow, that's pretty good. Pretty good focus there. You must be a blade master.
Yes.
It would be nice.
Seek the flame in the void.
He assumes the flame in the void. That's right. That would be cool, actually. keep trying that, but it's not working for me so far. Never seemed to sense the force either.
I kind of do know
the Cody. It's the same thing. Actually, the most often that I probably enter anything like the Cody is when you're gaming, when you're video gaming or something with, like, you know, not like World of Warcraft, but a skill game of some sort like that. When you get in the zone, you know, and you're not thinking about anything else, you're not doing anything else, you're one with the game, you're like zoned in on it, and you can really, that's when you can really score big, you know. But you
is
can't
it
get
sad? Am I the only one that finds it sad that the blade masters of today are gamers?
Yeah, totally. Or fighter pilots. I mean, it's the only way you can cope with a really stressful environment like that and succeed. A little bit in martial arts, but I never really got high enough up in martial arts to get good enough to where I could get in the zone like that. Very rare. Sometimes doing kata, but very rare. Not a natural martial artist by any stretch of the imagination. Much better gamer. Driving sometimes you can kind of get into that zone. But it's in this world to do it, and you don't get a lot of outlets for that.
Yeah, it's much easier when you can just walk a few, or half a league and you're in the middle of nowhere, whereas nowadays you have to walk a league to get in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah,
unless you live in the middle of nowhere like Virginia does.
Like I do, yeah. And you do too. But even then, I mean, in Manland, they're not the level of everyday distractions. I mean, they don't have TV, they don't have radio, they don't have podcasts, they don't have cell phones, oh my God. You know, they don't have, you know, newspapers, they don't have, you know, unless somebody walks up and talks to you, there's nothing else going on except what you're doing. You know, or something happens. I mean, some event happens. You know, you hear shouting down the road, or, you know, some runaway horse comes charging by you. What else is going to distract you? There isn't anything.
That's true. It's very true.
Books. That's it. Stick your nose in a book. That's the only one. That anything else can happen except what you're doing. So I think it's easier to concentrate when there isn't even the possibility of a cell phone call or, you know, any of that stuff happening. I think it's a lot easier to stay centered, you know, in a medieval sort of world. I think that's probably why they had a lot more spiritual, you know, type people, monks and so forth and so on. You know, they didn't, and even they would shut themselves away from the world. Even back in medieval times, you know, they would shut themselves away from the distractions of the world. I'm looking at it, what distractions? Try ours. You know?
Yeah. I can't lock myself away from the distractions of the world. I get a few fingers have to come back to my computer.
Yeah. It's weird.
In fact, begin sarcasm here. Or irony, whichever. It's a testament to the amazing writing ability of Robert Jordan and Brandon Sanderson that I was able to stay away from my computer long enough to finish this book.
I know. Well, I remembered what the I was right was, and a ton of people were right on this too, so I am hardly alone with that. But I was actually, and coincidentally, I found validation about it. I know we talked about it on a podcast, but I happened to run, I was trying to delete some of the 20,000 emails that I got backed up on my computer, and I was just going through it. I was only saving the ones from the, that were relating to the podcast in case they had crazy theories or something in them that we needed to go back and look for. And I ran into one that I had back and forth with Kevin Dean, and he was emailing us on the podcast email, and somebody said to me, "Oh, so you think Grendel's dead?" And I said, "Well, I'm not really sure. I think it's just coincidental. And I really would not be in the least surprised if she didn't just gateway out of there right before the destruction."
Lo and behold,
that's exactly what she did.
Yeah, I mean, and the largest part of that was finding a way to explain how the compulsion disappeared if Grendel, you know, were responsible. And if Grendel was responsible, she just wasn't responsible for creating the weeds of compulsion herself.
Yeah.
So, you know, I thought it was very clever of them to work that out so that, you know, we then not only got a plausible way for Grendel to have escaped, but also then we had the later conversation, which implicates, you know, with its implications, that, you know, Grendel is, you know, somewhat slightly less favored at the moment just because, you know, she has apparently been responsible for the deaths of more than one Forsaken, and they, it gave a little more depth to her entire little plot line there, and, you know, also sets us up for her being a greater danger, not to Rand, but to a number of people.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if she'll be a greater danger to anybody, but...
Not anymore.
Well, unless she's suitably punished and they decide to turn her loose again with suitable weaves of control or whatever, I don't know, but it sounds to me like she's pretty much going to be, you know, occupied for a little while. Kind of scary.
Yeah. Creepy.
Oh, yeah.
Creepy occupation. I did like I did like the line from Morden when he was chastising her. It's like, "You seem to be, I hope you're not making a habit out of killing the other Forsaken." The other Chosen, excuse me, because Morden's the other Chosen, but still.
So, you know, but I wasn't sorry to see Aaron Gar and Delana go. And I love the thing, it happened so long ago, so many people read the prologue so long ago, I think we've all kind of forgotten. We got a new word out of that too, Bale Scream.
Yeah, the Bale Scream.
Yeah.
How cool is that, you know?
Yeah, I like that one. Bale Scream.
Yeah.
Sounds like a
Transformer. Great minds, great gamers, think alike.
Bale Scream, terrorize.
Yeah, but
one of my favorite names for a Transformer, although he was one of the lamest of the Transformers, Starscream. I really like that name.
Oh,
if he hadn't been such a weaselly little coward, I would have named a dog after that.
He wasn't a coward. He was second in command.
Whatever. It's a weaselly little coward.
Yes, he was. But you're right. A lot of people had read the prologue beforehand, and, you know, they could get away with it because the prologue was so powerful. In fact, the entire book was just boom, 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 boom. Just revelation on revelation, amazing scene on revelation on amazing scene. And it's like, there's too much good here. We start in the prologue. Well, we start with Lon and then we go to Galad. But, you know, when I first listened to the prologue, I think, it's Grendel. What? Oh, it's a flashback. Oh, dang it. She's alive. I was listening at the time so I could say those things to myself because I wasn't actually reading. But still, it's like, wow.
I mean, the other thing that I've noticed so far in just reading through is, Yeah, I mean, yeah, it just solid hit after solid hit. But I mean, the characters' progression through the story also seems to be really, really well defined. I mean, we get, each pairing chapter sequentially, as I read them, is just a little more, it's more headway, more headway, more headway. I mean, you know, he starts off with his usual, I need to learn to control the wolf, and, you know.
I might turn into a wolf. I might lose myself. Emo Karen, as I call him. I hate that.
Yeah, and it dissolves. I mean, it doesn't do it immediately. It's not like a snap, oh, wait, I've been thinking about this all wrong. I mean, there are some minor moments where he has that sort of conclusion, but overall it progresses, and, you know, he's developing, and I was able to, you know, like, I mean, all the way up to, like, the forging scene was just, you know, or the actual forging scene, not the dream forging scene that we see in the prologue, but, the actual forging scene, I mean, it was just literally, like, the level of awesome just kept getting higher and higher and higher, and you're just like, thank you. This is the person you're supposed to be.
You were always supposed to be this good, but you just wouldn't accept it. And he finally accepted Hopper as the wolf spirit guide that he always was meant to be. And Perrin just treated him like an old friend, an old departed friend that he could see once in a while. It's like, you know, come on, Perrin. He's trying to help you. He's trying to teach you, and you're just getting your, you know, whiny, crying Perrin. And I love the fact that the forging dream that he had really was a precursor of the forging of his fabulous hammer. What is it? Ma Aligner? Because he makes those shapeless lumps of metal, but they're all in kind of the shape of the three pieces of metal that he ended up forging into the hammer, you know?
Yeah, the long, thin bar, which would be the haft.
The lump the size of two fists that was the maul, you know? Yeah, and the hidden shape. Yep. Yeah, that was pretty cool. Now, I didn't get that. I didn't get anything out of that. I was kind of baffled by that whole scene. But as soon as he started forging the hammer and making it, I realized, oh my God, he already dreamed this. He just didn't complete it, you know?
Yeah.
Power rot weapons again. Wow.
Yeah, because, you know, the wise ones and the Ashaman have no problem.
Yep. Neither do the kin of the sea folk have a problem. Only these stupid Aes Sedai are going to have an issue with power rot weapons again. Stupid Aes Sedai. What's the matter with these women? I guess I can still say that, even though I guess I kind of are one now. I got my name in the book. I got my name in the book. But
Baron is now a red sitter. Everyone
red sitter.
Shun her.
Shun.
Viria Canoro. I can't even say it. It's Viria Canoro. And I'm a sitter with a sister.
Viria Canoro.
Who is a sister? That's really
who is a sitter? Wait, what?
Yeah.
Well, and I love how, you know, that there's two of our podcasters have their names in the book, and one of them dies.
Amir hasn't been with us for a while, but Amir Yoeli actually got his complete name in there. He is Yoeli.
He is Yoeli,
yeah.
Or Yoeli, however you want to pronounce it.
I don't know how you say it, but major FaceTime there. I'm a minor walk on. I didn't mention. That's it. I don't care. I'm happy. Thrilled. Thank you. Yeah, Amir won the big drawing to get, you know, the Charles Guy Bond moment. You know.
Yeah. It's amazing. Go Amir.
Yeah, really. And he's cool. Very cool. I have to go through all of Brandon's Facebook postings and everything and figure out who was who. Like, I remember he emailed one guy, oh, congratulations, you're in the book, but you're not quite human. There were a bunch of little, you know, things like, I got to figure out which one was which, you know.
That's good. I had wanted to ask Harriet when I had the chance, when the series eventually becomes some sort of visual representation, be it movies or a television show or whatever have you. I actually was kind of curious that when we get to Robert Jordan's cameo in the series, if they'll actually release the rights to use his image in the creation of the library Terangreal. Because, I mean, I think that would be just really neat to have, you know, like, the Terangreal look like Mr. Jordan. I mean, it'd be really neat.
Oh, yeah. That would be cool. But it's described as being, like, a jolly Chapman or something, so I don't know.
The thing is they, it was mentioned, actually, it was mentioned at the Provo signing, during the trivia. It said, you know, Robert Jordan does have a cameo within the series, and it isn't loyal. And, you know, the answer is that, yes, apparently the Library of Tarangriel is supposed to be based on him.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean,
cool.
So, yeah.
That's awesome, because actually that's one of the things that I love of the Marvel movies, you know, this, Spider-Man and Iron Man and everything. Stanley always gets a little cameo in there. And it's great. You know, the people that know get it right away. The ones that don't, don't. But, okay, I love it. And, I mean, they went one better with the Iron Man ones. Not only does Stan Lee get in there, but the director's in there constantly. John Favreau is John Favreau? I don't know how you pronounce his name, but he's Happy Hogan, the bodyguard.
Yeah.
And, you know, hey, you get it or you don't. But he's good. Good.
Oh, yeah.
Totally works for me. Yes, I love that stuff. I mean, there were so many opportunities for little, you know, in the know stuff to go on. I actually wish that they would Stargate this one. I wish they'd make it a long running series. You know, hopefully that it would be popular enough to be long running. But if they,
I still think about it because I mean, at one point I had it sketched out. You know, where which seasons would be, or which seasons, which books could be combined into single seasons, so that you would. You wouldn't end up having, yeah, an opening movie and then 13 seasons worth of material because, I mean, it's just logistically not possible.
It wouldn't work, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's only 2 years of time in all the books, so you can't,
yeah.
You can condense it down.
That I think they would have to fudge through.
I mean, it would take more than 2 years to get it all produced and out. But you only need two. But there's only 2 years of time that you need to. The timeline is only 2 years long.
Yeah. Well, but you know what they. You know, you can fudge that. I mean, if you look at say Stargate, which was 10 seasons. You know, except for Jack O'Neill, you know, Richard Dean Anderson, nobody really aged that bad. You know,
yeah.
They all look pretty. They all look. I mean, they all look pretty much the same as they did when they started.
I mean, the way I had originally figured it out, and I wish I can't find the. Thing I had written it down on. I mean, I had broken it down as to, you know, which books go into which season. I mean,
yeah, you could do it in five.
It works out to about 2 to 3. Like, with 2 to 3 books a season, you could end up with a series that was, like, 5 to 7 seasons long.
Yeah, I think you could do 5. I mean, well, I mean, and if it was popular, they could certainly stretch it out. I mean, for God's sake, who would have ever imagined they could drag Smallville out as long as they have?
Yeah.
I mean, who would have ever thought there was that much backstory that could, they're still doing a pretty good job with it. I like it.
Yeah.
What are they on, season 9 now?
I think they're on 10.
Yeah.
Anyway, one thing though I would have to say about any TV movie adaptation is that Towers of Midnight and probably I don't know about Gathering Storm, but Towers of Midnight would have to be a TV season and then cliffhanger at the end like there is in this. And then A Memory of Light would be the final movie.
Yeah. Well, one thing
I don't know,
about
I'd be able to do Gathering Storm as a movie and then the Towers of Midnight season in between. That could be interesting. Yeah. I think I'd fudge what happens in each one a little bit differently so that it's a little more chronological, a little less jumping all over the place like this book is.
Yeah.
But
I think if they did it as movies, it would almost have to be like Harry Potter. It would have to be 6 or 7 movies. And I think they would really need to start from the beginning like they did at the end of Harry Potter, because obviously they didn't really, I mean, they probably kind of knew, but they didn't really know just exactly how incredibly popular that series was going to get toward the end. But they'd need to basically do a couple of movies at a shot, you know. You can't just tie people up for, you know, 7 years most of the time, even if they're fairly unknown actors. It's really hard. And then you've got the aging issue because you can't put out movies the way they do series. Now, if they did it, you know, the bad job right about doing it as a TV series is they generally don't have the budget for the massive special effects. But, you know, let's face it, most of the Wheel of Time doesn't require any more massive special effects than, say, Stargate did.
Yeah. I mean, that was my main reason for basing the... Yeah, you know, I mean, like I did what you did, Virginia. I kind of looked at Stargate and I went, well, you know, they had decent effects. I mean, we've also, it's been mentioned, and it was mentioned at the signing, you know, we've got George R. R. Martin's first book of A Song of Ice and Fire, The Game of Thrones, is coming out on an HBO series. From what little bit I've seen, it looks pretty good. The actors are all seem to at least fit my mind. And I mean, it's a pretty huge and like impressive cast. We have, Sean Bean, Boromir from, from Lord of the Rings, playing Eddard Stark. We have, don't remember his name right now. He played, Ronan in Stargate, Atlantis as Khal Drogo.
Oh yeah, yeah, Jason Momoa. Yeah.
He is Khal Drogo. And, you know, that series, of course, requires less impressive special effects because as someone at the, Cincinnati signing pointed out, you know, his world is intensively less magical. I mean, it is in some respects about the deconstruction of nobility in people, whereas Robert Jordan was really focused on, well, almost everybody has some innate nobility to them. They're kind of just opposite, like, poles of the spectrum. So, of course, the Wheel of Time would need more special effects. But, I mean, I really do think that given the technologies that we have at our disposal with, you know, production companies like HBO, and I think it's Paramount that runs Sci-Fi Channel, it's completely possible to do even a television series that has very, very good effects that, you know, will help to forward that idea.
Yeah, because the Wheel of Time books, even up until the last, are not really effects-driven. There are a lot of special effects, but there will be, if they did it as a series, there would probably be entire episodes where you wouldn't need to do much of anything, you know, in the way of special effects. It's all character interaction and so forth. You wouldn't need a lot. I mean, they don't channel constantly. They're not traveling constantly. You know, there isn't, you know, Balefire in every third episode. It isn't really like that. And a lot of that stuff can happen off screen if you do it a little bit. I mean, you don't have to show somebody opening a gateway every single time they travel in the later books. You know, they could probably get by with, you know, any number of episodes without very much in the way of special effects. And then save, you know, the budget for the episodes where you really need the big stuff going on. I think they could do it as a series pretty well. I would be happy with it either way, but I think if they do it as movies, they better plan on doing it, you know, two or three movies in a shot and then giving the actors a year off and then two or three more movies in a shot.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing they would also, I think they also would need to do if they did movies is one thing that really annoys me about the Harry Potter series is that they had an actor play Voldemort in the back of Quirrell's head in the first movie. And then when they got to where they needed Voldemort again, they just hire a new actor. I do not want to see that happen with Luz Thayer and Telamon. I want the actor that they hire for Dragonmount, for the prologue, to be the same as the voice actor that does the Luz Theron voiceovers in the later books.
Well, you know, but so see, again, like I said, when they did the first movie, they didn't finish the book series yet, you know, by a long shot.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, they still didn't really realize just how much of a phenomenon it was going to be. And sometimes, you know, things happen. I mean, I'm sure they didn't plan on changing Dumbledore either. I didn't like Richard Harris as Dumbledore, but I hated the guy they got to replace him. I can't even remember his name. Gambon or something like that.
Sarah something or another.
Yeah, it's horrible. They were all horrible. None of them were good Dumbledores. They were okay, but, you know, yeah. Whatever.
I liked the original Dumbledore myself.
Well, he was better than the one that they replaced him. I liked him a lot better after he died because I thought he was better than the one that they got to replace him. He didn't seem like Dumbledore to me. And there were a couple of scenes where, I mean, he was so manic, you know, in the Goblet of Fire or whatever. It's like, you know, what? You know, he was like totally out of character.
Not even Dumbledore.
No.
Anyway.
But we are definitely tangenting here. So back to the Towers of Midnight.
we're way off. I mean, we're not even on Towers of Midnight on the Wheel of Time movies anymore. We're on Harry Potter now. What?
Once we got off onto the series and movie possibilities, we went nuts though. So
that's
what
we're gonna have to do eventually.
I don't think we have to cut that out, but I don't know if we need to leave it in either. I don't know. But another one of my favorite things is that even though she is, like I said, getting back to the Towers of Midnight, another one of my favorite scenes is though even though she's pregnant, she's still managing to channel enough to create more Tauranguil. Elaine gets to use the Foxhead Tauranguil and make more, but she's not got them exactly right.
Yeah.
They figure prominently in the book.
See, I figure this comes back to one of my little pet theories that, you know, may or may not hold any amount of water. But like I said, I still think that the fox head and the Ashendari were created for Matt. And if that, I mean, that kind of implies that the Finns are responsible, at least in some part, for some interaction of the One Power. I don't necessarily want to, you know, affirm one way or the other that they are responsible for teaching people to channel, but it seems like it makes a certain amount of sense. And like I said, I might be completely wrong, and the end of this book will probably, you know, may possibly change my mind on this, but, you know, it just seems like maybe the reason she's not getting it right is because this is, you know, a Finn original as opposed to what humans are doing.
I think I'm actually, I don't know, because she couldn't get the dream soaring girl right either. You know, they're just,
I mean, it might just be that she's not very good at that talent.
Well, I'm not sure if it's that she's not very good. I think it might be more that she's only using Sadine, Sadar. Yeah, wow. I mean, I knew I had it wrong, but I couldn't get the words to come out right. Anyway, that she was only using Sidar and doesn't have Sidine there to help him out, to, you know, help create the Tarangriel.
Well, I think it's not so much that. I think it's that she's, because of her condition, you know, being pregnant and everything, she's just not able to weave as effectively as she normally could. Because
but
she did pretty well with her
when
first
Tarangriel.
Huh?
She wasn't pregnant when she made the first Tarangriel, and they had the same
similar
problem.
Yeah, but she's just learning. You know, she's just starting out. She's just learning. She's recreating a technology, basically, or a craft or a skill that's been lost for thousands of years. She has nobody to teach her how to do this. She's just doing it. So, yeah, I think she's doing really well. And I think it's just become harder for her to get it right now that she can't control the weaves as effectively as she used to. That's just my take on it, anyway. And I think she's doing amazingly well, considering nobody's done this in 3,000 years.
Were the Dream Tarangriel the ones, or the first ones that she made? Or was
yes, they were some of the first ones she made.
Or was it the Idom? It might have been the Idom that she made first.
Because
I think
that
she replicated
really
them.
Well.
Yeah, but, well, yeah. But then again, that's a Tarangriel that's been basically manufactured wholesale by the Shanchan, so maybe it's just an easier one to replicate. You know, it's only required to establish an involuntary circle with another person where the Dream Tarangriel are required to basically allow a person to enter another dimension. You know, it might be that the Dream Tarangriel are a little teeny bit more complicated.
That's true.
Just a little bit. I still don't know how she got this carving, a carving of a sleeping woman inside a block of amber. I mean, that's not easy. How did she do that? How did anybody do that?
Laser. They used the One Power as a laser.
Oh, yeah. And then bonded them together, I guess. Well, that's pretty cool when you think about it. Definitely an awesome process. And being a craftsperson at heart and an artist, I would really love to be able to do something like that, don't you know?
Yeah. Oh, well, I just had a weird question. Tell me what you guys think. We know that Matt's Foxhead Medallion defends against both Sadine and Zadar. Do you think that because Lane's copies have been made only with Sadar, that they only defend against it?
No.
I mean, we haven't seen any male channelers go up against the copies.
Mm-mm.
And of course, you know, there is also the flaw in Elaine's copies that if the weave is powerful enough, it'll override the buffer.
Yeah.
And they can't channel while they're holding it.
Yeah.
Which I loved how she used that when she was being an idiot in the dungeon.
Yeah.
She's not going to pretend to be one of the Forsaken.
Yes, that's nice.
Nothing can hurt me because Min said my babies would be fine. Oh boy, could we
And even when Brigitte says that, yeah, but just because your baby would be fine doesn't mean that you'll keep all your limbs to do it. You don't need your arms or legs to birth your baby.
Yeah, I like her setting her down on that one. It's like,
yeah.
And then
of course,
still didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, slap her. Slap the Queen of Andor. Oh my gosh, we've come full circle.
Yeah. And of course, us modern people, you know, are sitting there going, hello, you ever heard of a C-section, have you? Huh? We could cut those babies out of your dead body. Duh. They might live and you might not.
That would actually, I think I would like to see, I mean,
plenty of women die during childbirth. I mean, you know, women get in car accidents and die and deliver their babies as they're expiring.
Well, they don't want to get in a car accident, complications of birth, kill mothers all the time, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, too.
Well, and even more so in a slightly post-medieval world. I mean, even up to the Renaissance, childbirth was still horribly, horribly dangerous.
It's still horribly dangerous. I mean, when you really think about it, it's one of the most dangerous things that you can do on purpose. Plenty of people in these days die. I mean, you can get an embolism and you're gone. I actually had a dog die that way. We took her down to the vet. We had an ultrasound. She had 7 live heartbeats, puppies kicking all over the place. She was huge. Woke up the next morning. She was dead at the end of my bed. She threw an embolism and that's it. She died in her sleep. I raced her down to the vet and tried to save the puppies, and 2 of them lived for about 20 minutes, but it had just been just a little bit too long. You know, there were 2 other dogs sleeping near her. Nobody heard a thing. She just died in her sleep. It's dangerous being pregnant. Not a fun thing to do, really, considering that so many people do it on a regular basis. But, that could definitely happen to her.
Well, and I just realized something. The huge meet and greet that Glenn's holding, this will be the first time that Rand sees his lover with child.
Yeah.
I don't know how that's going to affect him. I mean, I don't think it would have affected the stone man that he was, you know, before the end of the gathering storm, but now that'll be interesting to see.
You sort of mentioned this, but am I completely forgetting something? But has Avienda has she been with Rand enough to conceive yet?
No.
So that's, you're probably right.
The original time.
That's way too long in the past. That's, believe me, she would not be running for Ruidian if she'd been that far along pregnant, especially with 4. and that's a person who would need bed rest, you know, somebody with quads. They do that, actually. It's very dangerous to carry that many babies, and a lot of women, you know, have breakthrough bleeding and so forth and so on, and are put in bed for just that exact reason, because if they mess around too much, those babies are going to come way too early.
Yeah.
So, you're probably right. You guys mentioned it earlier. That probably is the odd thing, that she's going to be able to conceive in the amount of time. Of course, nobody says that these babies are going to be born before the last battle.
I don't think they will be.
That might all happen after, you know, post Tarmon Gaiden. You know, she'll maybe conceive before the last battle, and that'll be it.
The other thing that was brought up recently was, you know, the use of the word have as opposed to give birth. Because Min says that Avienda would have Rand babies. Doesn't necessarily mean that she gives birth to them. And if something does happen to Elaine, that 2 babies without a mom having kids could technically imply that, you know, bearing in possession of, as opposed to.
The thing about that, Andrew,
the book,
is,
I think you'll see.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's minor spoiler, but you do see that she has quadruplets.
Okay. Well, we see that she has 4 kids, and it's strongly implied that they're hers and Rand's.
Okay.
They say that they are quadruplets, which means that they are born at the same time.
Yeah.
Good. That
clears that up.
Spoiled that for you. Sorry.
Sorry.
No, I mean, that is in the, you know, events of discussion, and I mean, that's not something that is ethically dire that, you know, would have ruined the experience of reading, so.
Although we're not going to tell you how she finds out, because that would ruin the experience.
You'll still be plenty impressed with the scene, I think, when you see it. It's pretty cool, really. And knowing what Brandon has said in the past didn't surprise me at all. I will say that.
So do you two have anything more to add to our first impressions of Towers of Midnight?
Oh, I could probably go on for another 3 hours. I mean, it was freaking amazing. Amazing.
It very much was.
I know there are things that I've missed.
I was very happy with the character voices this time around. I definitely think that any inconsistency from the Gathering Storm were cleared up rather nicely, with a minor exception, that being that there were a few instances in which people spoke a little too colloquially for their period. I mean, like, some of the Aiel would use contractions in places that I didn't think that they naturally would.
Yeah.
But other than that, by and large, the voices of characters were much, much closer to the way I remember them and the way the characters were acting by the time of Robert Jordan's passing.
Yeah. There is one thing, an error I have to point out. I have never seen this anywhere else, but anywhere else in the Wheel of Time or in any of Brandon's books. But there was one part where he broke viewpoint. You know, section was from Fael's viewpoint, and then just for like two paragraphs, he switched to Perrin's viewpoint and then came back.
There was one little sort of kind of error that I thought I saw, and then it was sort of repeated and accepted later on. So I guess she's just changed her mind. Brigitte, when she goes to meet with what turns out to be Matt, is wearing a sword. And I was like, what? She's been so adamant about not ever, I mean, she's been like an Aiel, basically, about not touching a sword. I mean, she doesn't want to wear one or use one because she says she's killed herself or she almost killed herself every time she's ever done it. And she just prefers the bow. And blah, blah, blah. And then there's a scene later on in the book where it says wearing a sword, dash, reluctantly, dash, blah, blah, blah. And so I'm going, oh, okay. Why did she change? Why did she change her mind? Does this harbinger her death? Is this a harbinger of her death? Because every time she said it many times during the series, every time that she's picked up a sword, she's either nearly killed herself or actually gotten killed. Not killed herself, but she's either nearly gotten herself killed or actually gotten herself killed. Didn't kill herself with it. But you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, that is a little bit. I guess 12 is put in the room. I found it disjointing having Perrin's point of view so far back in time and then having to read subsequent views with Tam at two different times. Yeah. Yeah, that was a little, oh, yeah, I forgot Perrin was so far behind everybody.
Well, and it's also, it is that we get Tam leaving for Tyr almost right after I think we either see him in Tyr or see a point of view from someone who is near him in Tyr much later. And it was just like, oh, well, that is kind of bizarre because, you know, he's already there, but then he's not. And
yeah, yeah. I mean, it switches from, I think it was Min's point of view when Rand comes back to Tyr and goes and apologizes to his father, and then we switch from Perrin's point of view where he's talking with Tam in the middle of the camp.
Yeah, there were a couple of little oddities there, but
I do also think, though, that Matt's Binder staffiness, which is the best way I can describe it, was at least, I was appreciative that they at least began to explain, you know, why he was like that, you know, that kind of jokes with Tom about, you know, well, you're kind of revisiting my, you know, my lost youth. And
I did like the moment with Tom when he said, you know, Tom was going out, I think as the merchant again to get information, and Matt said, well, do you want me to make an alias for you?
A backstory.
Tom kind of laughs. No, I'm good. I'm good.
I've got it covered.
Yeah.
I did see that after
the fact, but the idea is still funny.
Yeah. I had to agree, Andrew and I had a discussion about this last night when we were thinking of idea recording going on and then just decided we couldn't do it. I have to agree with the cool girlism. There were a couple of places where the wise ones and the Aes Sedai said wouldn't have happened or, you know, wouldn't have worked anyway. They just wouldn't say that. There's no way they would say that. They were the wise ones and the Aes Sedai in particular were very formal. They weren't ever colloquial or slangy or anything like that. And there were a few other places where I thought that Tom and a few of the other people, they just wouldn't have expressed themselves in quite that fashion. And I still say, I still say Matt is closer, but he's still not white Matt in my mind. But that said, I can forgive all that. I love the book. It was amazing. It was great. Very, very little bothered me about it. I mean, as I've said before, and I apologize to Brandon in particular, we, you know, it's our nature to try and pick things apart because that's what we do. You know, we're trying to figure out clues, trying to do that. You know, we're nitpicky. That doesn't in any way mean that we didn't absolutely love these books that you're working on. So just, you know, take it as read. It's our nature to focus on every little tiny detail. And it doesn't mean that we don't love what you're doing. Because we do. The book is made of awesome. I mean, there were so many epic moments. Just like Jason and Jennifer were teasing me on our little spoiler pre-book podcast. I mean, how can you pick one? There isn't. There were so many incredibly epic moments. That's all I say.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of feel like we're teasing Jason with some spoilers here, but meh.
Yes, guess well, the boots. Oh, I love the boots metaphor. It's not a metaphor, it's a boot.
That was funny.
That was pretty funny. And I didn't even see where he was going with that. You know, I kind of would have thought, you know, the best boots would be for, you know, the grandest occasions. No, I want your best boots to walk in. That totally makes sense. Anybody who's walked a long time will get that one.
Yeah, that does make sense. Wow.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's nothing if not practical.
Yeah,
and
there are a few points in this book that sometimes I just want to record just so that I have myself reading them, and that's one of them.
Yeah.
But it's,
and we see what Easing the Badger is in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think you've got there yet, Andrew. It's a throwaway, not a major scene.
I did like the acorns, though.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty funny. That was pretty funny. Sorry, Andrew, we're teasing you with that, too.
All right.
It's not it's another throwaway. It's not a big thing.
I will get there eventually.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think we've exhausted all of the possibilities for this book discussion yet.
Oh,
so,
no.
I hope not. We've only been discussing it for a couple hours.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yes, Guest 12. I agree with that, Guest 12. I found myself shouting out loud more often, just going, yes! Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do have to say, I'm grateful that I actually got to read two large sections of the book devoted to Perrin and Gawain without flinching. I actually can like those two characters again. Thank you, Brandon.
Yes.
Thank you, Robert Jordan.
Gawain. Oh.
Ego, Gawain,
this has renewed my determination to play Gawain in whatever screen adaptation there is.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, he's not just an idiot. Okay, I can do this.
Yeah. But the length of the time you have to be a total jerk. I mean, not even a jerk.
Nah,
just a little whiny emo boy, you know? I couldn't, for the longest time, I almost couldn't see at the beginning. I totally could see what Egwene saw in him. And then for a couple of books, it's like, ah, dude, you know, like, you know, grow a pair.
I did like, and I just checked, so you know this, Andrew, but I did like how he resolved his issues with Rand before he even ever saw that Morghese was alive.
Yeah.
And, you know, before it actually came to blows, he's just like, you know what, never mind. I'm not going to allow you to control my life like this. I'm going to leave you alone. Goodbye. And then he went back to Egwene and saved her life.
Yeah.
Although I am worried about what he's going to do with the blood knife rings, because if he uses one of them like an idiot, he will die, and then I'll be annoyed at him again.
Well, I don't think he knows how to use them. You know, you have to use your blood on them to activate them, and I have a feeling that they may be a one-off. You know, once they're blooded and activated, that may be it for them. They may be dead, inert, and unusable, but that's just my take.
But what if they're not?
What if they're not
usable, but the reason that they would kill you is because it was your blood that activated them?
Yeah.
So what if he can still use them like the blood knives without having to make the blood sacrifice?
Well, that's a thought. We don't know much about these Tarangreal, but I suggest you better have somebody who knows what they're doing, check them out. And, you know, he doesn't even know
Avienda.
That Elaine knows how to create. He doesn't even know that Elaine knows how to create Tarangreal, or that Avienda knows how to read them. He's been pretty much in the dark. He's been sitting in Darain or whatever it is in the little village whining for the last however many books.
From the very beginning when they were talking about, you know, sisters dying in the tower, I'm like, yeah, you know, we only saw one blood knight die in the storm. There were five of them.
Yeah, I'll admit, I was just a little bit thick. I didn't even think of the blood knives until the Shantan one was like, the blood knife blade. And I was like, don't!
Yeah,
you know, like the one knife that went soaring through the air and almost killed Gawain if he hadn't stepped to the side, or, you know, and he comes back and there's on it. And I'm like, yeah, that's why. Why are people so intent on it being Persona? It makes such perfect sense.
I did think that it was just a little bit fortuitous that he just happens to be holding his hand when he just happens to be walking by a Damani who just happens to notice the knife and happens to know what it is. Yeah.
There's no such thing as coincidence in the Wheel of Time.
And then there just happens to be a former Sildam who is amazingly of the low blood and knows exactly what the... No, that was a bit of a stretch for me. I mean, it's not like Gawain is Tavirin. draws what he needs to him. That was totally coincidence.
No. There is any number of reasons why the Taveren would have pulled that into motion. If they did not want Egwene to die, they would have
that. Wait a minute. It has never been said that Taveren affects second and third parties at a distance.
Yes,
it's always they are affecting the people around them. He can't.
Yeah, but I mean, the warp of the pattern, I mean, you twist, you know, one thread a certain way and it can pull, you know, progressively more and more threads in that particular direction. So, I mean, it's not likely, but it's possible that,
okay.
they could have distorted the Wii far enough.
Well, and you have to think of the fact that, you know, the Taveren draw what they need to them. Well, that means that the pattern has to set in motion getting what they need to them long before they actually need it.
Okay. But I don't like that because that gives them, you know, that just gives them, it's too much power. I mean, now you can say, okay, anything can happen in the book because it's Vera's alive. Anyway.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what it's been set up to do. That's what it's been set up to mean.
Yeah.
Taveren is the ultimate deus ex machina. And it's made that way.
I don't necessarily know that they're the ultimate deus ex machina. I think the ultimate is Rand's happy, shiny creator brain coding.
Happy, shiny brain coding.
That reminds me.
I mean, yeah, creator, happy, shiny brain coding.
Yeah. Well, I guess 12 points out another thing about the coincidence of Gawain just happening to have the knife is, but they are tied close to the Taveren. You know, they may not be physically close, but their threads in the pattern are very much near the three boys.
Not Gawain. No.
He's very much near Egwene, who is sitting smack dab next to Rand.
No, she's not. She's not even close to him.
Oh, yes, she is. You think about her thread in the pattern? And she is tied almost as tightly to Rand as Matt and Perrin are. Not quite,
well,
but almost.
Well, maybe, but, you know, they haven't even talked to each other for books and books and books. I mean, for months and months and months and months and months.
And?
Except in this book. But, I mean, no, I think that's just too remote. That, again, that gives the author just too much power to let anything in the world happen.
That's been the way these books have been set up since the beginning, Virginia.
No, there's always been a logical consistency to it. And it's never been said that Taveren influenced other people at one remove, at second remove. Yes, he does tug the pattern and he does draw what he needs to them, but there's a limit to what he can do. Otherwise, he would have just brought everything into line and won the last battle books ago.
Except that Rand was not properly using his powers at the time.
Well, but he's always been Taveren, and the three boys have always been Taveren. I mean, they're even more strongly, obviously, Perrin has increased in Taverenness dramatically, and he doesn't even know how to use it or try to use it, but still. But you look back at all the books, all the things that the Taveren have done by being Taveren have brought something they needed personally into their vicinity. You know, Perrin drew Galad into his vicinity. You know, he didn't influence Galad to do something else that would, you know, provide him with something else. It was he brought a person into his sphere of influence. You know, he brought this item into his sphere of influence. He didn't, if you start jumping two and three steps away, it just gives him too much power in the book, in a plot. I mean, okay, whatever. I give up.
No, I mean, we don't really know. I mean, that's kind of it is very possible that, you know, maybe it is just a huge coincidence, or, you know, there could also be the fact that, you know, Rand, Matt, and Perrin are really unusual in how long they've been Taveren. I mean, for a lot of people, it is a temporary process. Maybe for a very, 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 very short moment in time, and that, you know, Gawain was Taveren just enough to have, you know, the pattern pull in the direction he needed it to be for him. Or, you know, Egwene, for that matter, or somebody like that. I mean, it is, you know, it's not the strongest theory that we could come up with, but, you know, who knows? It could, like I said, just be a giant coincidence.
Changing the topic slightly, did anyone else think that there might be some strange connection between the all-caps voice that we heard at the end of The Eye of the World and this Nakomi that Avienda meets?
Yeah, I don't know about Lillian Nakomi. She almost seemed more like a wolf spirit guide to me, in a way. I'm actually kind of surprised that the Aiel don't have more, you know, shamanistic things like that. I mean, the wise ones kind of do, the ones that are dreamers anyway, but the Gwen of Aiel don't seem to have a lot of traditions like that, you know, the wise person appearing to them.
I just have this nagging feeling, especially now that we've seen her, that there's been a lot of parts where we've seen the creator, you know, help just a little bit, just send a little bit of guidance that we just haven't picked up on. I mean, we know that the people in the world think that the creator won't, you know, stretch his hand in and save them, which he probably won't. But that doesn't mean that he won't help and guide as much as he is able.
I thought he took no, you know, I thought he was non-interference.
That's what the people in the world believe, but we know that they're mistaken about any number of things.
That's true.
Guest 12 says, we know that Talaren Onriad, well, is failing. So could it be someone from the world of dreams, maybe a Jen'ail? That is an interesting theory, that someone who had been living in the world of dreams somehow crossed over.
I don't know.
Is the world of dreams a resting place for any more than well, wild souls like the wolves and the heroes of the horn?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot we don't know about the world of dreams. A lot of the characters don't know about the world of dreams. I mean,
a lot we're hoping to see in the encyclopedia about the world of dreams.
Yeah, I don't know. Probably too big a topic for my brain at this point in time.
That's true.
I have to think about that.
Yeah, my brain is still full of the epicness that is pretty much the last few chapters.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest of the book as well, but especially his last two chapters is just like, pound, 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 pound. And I have to form coherent thoughts about them before I can spend much time talking. Just a little bit, you know?
I know. As I said earlier, I raced through this book during one of the most work-filled and stressful weeks I've had in many, 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 many years. So, I think I'm going to immediately, now that I finished it, turn around and start it over again and read it in the most great.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I thought one other little kind of interesting thing is that during that scene with the Borderlanders, you know, they're saying, oh, you know, well, we met in formatting, you know, on purpose because, you know, Shinobi is kind of implying, well, you know, you can't channel here, you know. Man, since you don't know how close you came to Doom, you know, if I'd come to you but a short time earlier, I'd have returned those slaps with Balefire. Inside the Guardian, Tenobius sniffs disdainfully, another sniffer, and Rand says, the Guardian blocks the One Power, Rand whispered, the One Power only. What does he mean by that? Cat Swain thought, frowning. Rand is literally implying that he could have used the True Power against them, too.
And would have.
I think
and would
he
have.
Would have. He's so close to the evil Rand. But, you know, and that's another thing. I'm going to go back to that scene where we knew it was epic when we saw it in The Gathering Storm. But in this book, we have even more scariness revealed to us about that. I mean, he was so close to making the decision that the wolves talk about that this could have gone either way. I mean, truly the future was balanced on the edge of a blade. As Nicola's prophecy said, you know, it could have gone either way. He could have become basically evil, scary Rand forever, and the Dark One would have won. Or he goes the other way, and we get to actually fight the last battle. Well, that doesn't seem like two very good options. Dark One wins, and the world becomes as nothing. Time is unwound and killed. The Serpent of Time is killed, and now everything is nothing. Or we get to fight the last battle, and the Dark One can still win. What kind of options are those when you think about it? I mean, at least they have a chance, but it's not. The decision wasn't win or lose. The decision was lose absolutely or maybe lose.
Yeah, you know, and I love how Rand points out that, you know, if he had been lose there in Telamon in that position, the world would be lost. But because he was Randall Thor, with the upbringing and friends and family that he had, he was able to withstand.
Yeah, I was raised better. I love that.
Yeah, I love that line. So what's the difference? I was raised better. Oh. Okay.
So what was the problem with Luz Theron's childhood? You come from a broken home?
I have a feeling that, someone with the, ability to, eventually become the, Tamerlan, as he did, you know, the first among equals, one of the most, in fact, the most powerful channeler of the age. I have a feeling that his childhood would have been marked with much, tutoring and people expecting lots of things from him and not much love and care.
He, as opposed to Rand, kind of growing up on his own and getting thrown into things, you know, with no training whatsoever. I mean, he did have the raising of Tam and everything to set him in the right path. I think what a powerful influence that gave Tam Althor on how the world went.
Yeah. Well, and everyone in the Two Rivers, really. Every single one in Emmons Field.
Yeah.
Is responsible for the fact that the world hasn't ended yet.
It's pretty incredible. I'm thinking to myself that there was another, we haven't even discussed the Barum scene yet.
Oh, I'm specifically staying away from the Black Tower because Andrew hasn't gotten there yet, but it does worry me.
Yep, that's a whole basket of snakes they haven't even really opened yet. And that's one of the chapters that I basically kind of flew through last night while I was asleep. So I thought the whole interaction between Perrin and Gowan was pretty amazing too when you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah, Perrin and Gowan, that was just really, I enjoyed it, I think, a little bit. I mean, obviously, Vire annoyed everybody, and Galad was almost perfect to a fault, and Morghese kind of annoyed me at times, too. But still, the actual way they behaved themselves between each other was very, very well done.
Yeah, and Perrin was so determined, you know, to do the right thing. He had all these influences kind of pushing him to do the wrong thing with Galad that,
including his wife.
Yeah, you know, and yet he just, you know, he really grew in this book. He really became what he always should have been. I'm just sorry it took him so long. I mean, I guess it couldn't really have gone any other way, but he's really become an epic hero now. I mean, all this time he's really been sort of a, I don't even say, kind of reminded me a little bit in places of Boromir. He just seems so weak, you know, weak and particularly self-serving, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess 12 asked a question that I kind of had. I mean, what is the matter with Elaine where she's coming out and threatening to execute them the minute that Perrin shows up and talks to her, and why didn't Perrin snap at her for that?
Yeah,
I will never understand why Elaine and Morghese are like, well, I can't believe these people who we have ignored for the last several centuries would dare think to raise themselves to any form of prominence. Oh,
yeah.
Please.
I know, I thought that was arbitrary in the extreme. And Elaine knows the Two Rivers better than that because of her interactions with Rand, you know.
And Egwene, and Nynaeve.
And Egwene, and Nynaeve, and everybody. I mean, she had to know there isn't any insurrection happening in the Two Rivers. But yeah, this whole thing kind of, that kind of bugged me. I guess Elaine is still sort of trying to find her, you know, her center as a queen. But
more that too. I mean,
that scene,
really?
Yeah, that whole scene thing seemed really kind of dumb to me. I would have thought they would have had a little more forbearance for the Dragon Reborn's best buddy,
well,
you know, than to just be offering
even
to execute
if not,
him.
Even if, I mean, yeah, that was stupid in and of herself. Well, we have the Dragon Reborn and two other Teverin, but one of them has annoyed me a little bit, so I think I'm going to kill him.
Yeah, I'll offer to execute him. That makes
yeah.
sense to me.
But even beyond that, I mean, really. So they raise the flag of the Netherin. Okay, you're upset at that? Why? Do they even know they're part of Andor? Have you made any attempt at all in the last several centuries to let them know that they are part of your kingdom and that you care for them? It's not just that you're going to show up and take their money, you know, tax collectors. Is that you care for them.
Yeah.
If you had at any point shown them the benefits of being part of your kingdom, they might not have kicked your tax collectors out.
They kicked the tax collectors out. I think Andor just stopped bothering to send them.
It was too far to go for too little, too little gain.
Yeah. They never kicked him out. They just stopped showing up.
Well, after they became important again and they tried to send tax collectors, they were said, no, get out.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, all those generations ago, seven generations, it was saying that they've seen, since the Two Rivers had even seen even a tax collector, let alone, you know, any troops for protection or anything like that. or any guidance from the Crown whatsoever at all. So, yeah,
yeah,
I'd kick him out
nothing.
Too if he hadn't shown up for all that time.
Nothing. Well, I love, Guest 12 has pointed out that that Matt's entire army, the original band of the Red Hand, was a personal one for the leader of the Netherlands. He doesn't have a problem with that.
Yeah. Well, that was during the,
I mean, but that,
that was during the Trolloc Wars.
The band isn't tied to any one nation. I mean, it's, you know, the band was a mercenary group, essentially.
Yeah.
And, you know, she wanted to nationalize them in order to, in order to, you know, take part of that away, you know, so that, you know, they were tied to Andor and not to anyone else, so that they couldn't be used against her at some point. So, I mean, it is partially just, I think, that political training that she's grown up with that she hasn't ever had to exercise prior to becoming queen herself.
Yeah. Well, well, and it's so annoying. Elaine's doing it. Egwene's doing it. They're saying, well, here I am, the center of stability and peace, and everyone should be tied to me. Yes, tied to me. Get your butt over here and be tied. Fine, whatever. I mean, Elaine's trying to do it with, you know, the Two Rivers and the band, like you said, and Carheen as well, which she was actually successful in that one. Egwene's trying to do it with every single female channeler in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Yeah, that's gonna work. Yeah,
that's funny.
Those are two women that do need slaps.
Yeah, that's really a hoot when you think about it. Yeah, they, well, you know, these women all have sort of delusions of grandeur now. They've all, well, Elaine always sort of had them. She was raised to be queen, but queen, boy, has she come a long way from the innkeeper's daughter. Well, they said that over and over again in the books, but it's really true. Well, she's sort of taken imperiousness to a whole new level, and look at the disaster it brought her to. Almost, when she tried that on with Gowan, you know, she's pushing him around, and of course, Sylviana didn't help. You know, she sent him this, I'm sure, snottily worded little note that probably was a lot snottier than Egwene intended it to be, and they basically pushed Gowan away, and thank goodness he came to his little mini-epiphany and decided to go back anyway, or Egwene would have been toast. Three blood knives, I'm pretty sure they would have taken her out while she was asleep in Teleron Riad battling the Black Asha and Misana.
That could have been interesting. She's in the middle of this, her fight with Misana, you know, this fight of wills, and all of a sudden she's stabbed and she dies. And Misana's
well,
like,
she would have just probably vanished from Teleron Riad. You're dead.
Wait,
you stop
what?
Dreaming when you die, yeah.
Hmm. Misana's like, wait, what? Hmm. It just goes on with her business.
Did Misana have any connection with the Shan-Chan that we know of? I know she mentioned that she wished that she'd gotten more out of Cimarron before she was killed, but did she actually have any connection with him, or was that just a fortuitous coincidence for her?
I think it was coincidence myself.
And what about Fortuana? I mean, what's going to happen with her and Matt, you think? We saw her appear a couple of times in this book.
Oh, I can only hope that at some point in time, Matt finds some way to basically remove the whole imperial mindset, because the whole tiered structure that they have, it just breeds corruption, and it's not a good thing.
I really think Fortuana needs to spend some time as a Demani. I think a little cholera and maybe with Nynaeve or something like that might do her a world of good.
She can't keep going on this. Shan-Chan cannot keep going on like this. We saw in Avienda's visions that if she does, it's going to end in ruin and disaster.
Well, for the Aiel, it'll be fine for the Shan-Chan.
Well, for the rest of the world, yeah, it'll be fine for the Shan-Chan, but we know that's not, I hope, against hope, that's not what Robert Jordan was planning on writing.
Well, that's why I'm hoping that the vision of the columns can be altered for the future. I mean, obviously you can't go back and alter the past, but let's hope that the future isn't set. I mean, are we to assume that that is just the most likely outcome, or is that it? You know? If that's true, then the remnant of the remnant aren't even going to be saved to the Aiel. They'll all be basically enslaved and wandering beggars. You know, how pathetic that would be.
Yeah. I certainly hope not.
Because that also implies if the Shan-Chan make a major victory that the last battle is going to be pretty much a waste of time as far as Randland's considered. Who cares if they win or lose if the Shan-Chan are going to take over and they're all going to be under their thumb afterward? Now, all of the Glaydon's plans will certainly go into ruins. There won't be any channeling. There won't be any White Tower. There won't be any Kin. There won't be any Seafolk. There won't be any anything. There'll just be the Shangchen and Soldom and Damani.
Yeah, that's one thing that has to be. Maybe the Forsaken were involved. I think Grand will probably come out with some pointed revelations, maybe that the Forsaken were involved with Hawkwing Guest 12. You know, I don't know what that would do if Rand were to tell them, yes, I've met with Ishamael, and he's told me point blank that he sent you across the ocean to become a scourge. I don't know what they would think of that. They would probably call him a liar. I don't think that breaking the Shanshan will be as easy as he broke the Aiel.
Well, the Aiel were all set up, you know, to be, you know, broken that way, basically. I mean, their whole prophecies and everything basically had them set up for that to happen. And that's not true with the Shangchen. They aren't expecting or on board with any of that. They're expecting Rand to kneel to the Crystal Throne, and that's the end of it.
Yeah.
They'll serve the Empress.
And I would be surprised if we don't see at some point in time, you know, him having to actually bow before the Empress, even if it's just not actually submit to her will, but bow before her. But I do not believe that. I don't know. The thing with Avienda is really, really quite telling. And I hope that the future, that she can change it. And I think we're spoiling Andrew just way too much now.
Yeah, probably so. Keep forgetting where you are in the book.
Actually, I just kind of tuned out for a little while there.
Good.
Heard it edging towards places I hadn't been.
Yeah.
Guestwell says to be angry about... Well, wait. Oh, he's talking about something else. The other thing that bothers me with Ashanchin is that Fortuana considers herself on the White Tower as a success after she thought Rand would be angry about it. I think. Yeah, it's like, they consider that a success? Well, what were they expecting? What would have a failure have been? I mean, how many of the Tauroken did Egwene blast out of the sky, and somehow the raid was still a success, even after all the losses?
Well, they got a lot of they got a lot of new Damani, and they made a lot of damage and killed a lot of sisters and captured some. They can breed more Tauroken.
Left nice behind.
Those were always meant to die. Bloodlines were always meant to die.
Yeah.
And they can breed more Tauroken. They'll make more Bloodlines.
Yeah. I have to wonder if they were expecting the Aes Sedai to fight back more, even though they knew that the Aes Sedai were bound in such a way because of some of the ones they had collared. I wonder if they were expecting them to fight back more or less.
Well, I mean, the Oath don't bind them from defending themselves in fear of their lives, and they were definitely in fear of their lives, so that wasn't a problem. They fought back as hard as they could. I think Fortuana was surprised that they didn't fight back better. If it hadn't been for Egwene, it would have been a walk to Shanshan. I mean, for God's sake, the Captain General of the Greens is running in terror, not marshaling the Aes Sedai to fight back. She's running through the halls in a panic. If it hadn't been for Egwene and her overcoming of her dose of Forkroot and going and getting the Angreal, what was it, Bora's Rod or whatever, I can't remember the name, Bora's Sangreal,
yeah.
And marshaling the novices together to form circles, the Shanshan would have walked all over the White Tower. It would have been destroyed completely. They probably would have, you know, captured every Aes Sedai that they didn't kill, torn the White Tower to the ground, and salted the earth the way Tuan said that she thought would happen.
Yeah. Oh, well, I guess Twelve has clarified a little bit more. He means that Tuan thought that Rand would be angry attacking the White Tower, so why does she think that a second attack is going to make anything better?
Because she's the Empress of Shanshan, may she live forever, and she's not necessarily a rational being.
Oh my gosh. I mean, that dress she's wearing that has sewn into it, the Empress is Shanshan. The Empress must be obeyed. You put that on your clothing?
Yeah.
Oh.
You know, don't think like we do, kiddo.
Oh, but I think a lot of that, Guest 12, is that she still believes that Rand is a puppet of the White Tower, which a lot of people still do, not no one who has met him and actually talked with him, but, well, I take that back, Tuan has met him and talked with him, but it was freaking frightening.
And he was still evil Rand then, too. I think the only thing that would have been cooler about that, And they couldn't do it because it would have been a ripoff. But I mean, I could almost see Rand becoming like Evil Willow and Buffy with the runes sliding down his face and arms and everything like that, the darkness taking over. You know, that would have been kind of cool to have a visual of something like that, but I'm just glad he's over.
But then we got the air warping in darkness around him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Halo of Darkness is pretty evil.
Yeah. And now we've got the air warping and lightness around him. The exact opposite. How cool is that? That happened in, what, Apple's First? Even non-channelers could see the warping.
Well, we're coming up on 3 hours, and I think now might be a good time to cut this off. Obviously, we are going to have to do many, many, many more episodes about Towers of Midnight because it is that epic. No, I thought we'd just leave it for another year and then just ignore it.
No, we're gonna wait, you know, 8 months, and then we're gonna start our recap of it.
It's not gonna be 8 months before I know to do another read through, let me tell you.
Well, and really quickly, I'd like to thank those guests that have been with us. While we've recorded guest 12, we still have guest 13 on the phone. There have been a couple others who have been in here. Someone. That's a nice username. Unfit Cheetah. That's an interesting one. And then, of course, Randall Thor was in here briefly, but he didn't want to get too spoiled, so so he bugged out, but that's okay. And, of course, we want to thank TalkShoe for the service, and we want to thank DragonMount.com, our host, especially Jason, for doing all the amazing, wonderful things that he's had to do behind the scenes to make sure that we can continue sending our podcast out to you.
Yep. And, of course, Brandon Sanderson, Harriet Rigney, and Team Jordan, Maria Simmons and Alan. I'm not going to try his name right now because I don't remember how to spell it. I don't remember it well enough to take a stab at it, but Maria and Alan as well. So, you know, without them, none of this would be happening either. So for our enjoyment, all these people have pulled together and brought us another fantastic book. That will wrap up this episode of our first impressions of Towers of Midnight. We hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the book as much as we have. You know we'll be coming back to this again. So this is Virginia saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
For myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Suravian and Zilmanshima, say you should pay.
To contact the Fourth Age podcast, visit our website at dragonmount.com/podcast.